Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Dusty White, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune of Corumdale Church and Pastor Chris Himmelman of First City Church. And on Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about where the trans conversation is headed.
We'll get there in a second. First, little snack shout out today to Dexter. Dexter is a guy that lived in Bellevue for a while, was a part of our church, and then moved to California a couple years ago. Here's the funny story, guys. I was in the airport in Austin, Texas, 3 weeks ago. I was buying myself some tacos because...
Yeah, why not?
When I'm in Austin...
When in Austin, get tacos.
Yeah, my goal is when I'm in Austin, I literally eat tacos for as many meals as possible because arguably it's the best taco town in the United States of America. So I just eat tacos for every meal. And in the Austin airport, there is amazing food. It's an unusual airport. And one of the places is this local taco place. So I was buying some tacos and I was coming back over to my gate and this dude just like jumps out in front of me and it was Dexter. And what was funny was he
with
thought
a big smile, I assume.
Well, because he thought I had seen him from far away. And so he assumed I was like walking over to talk to him, but really I hadn't recognized him yet. And so he just like jumped out in front of me. I was like, whoa, what are you doing here? And long story short, Dexter's moving to Texas. He was there interviewing for a job. And so he then sent us, Dusty, this soul food-inspired popcorn.
Very well packaged. I mean, at first when you opened the box the other day, I thought, oh, somebody sent us some coffee.
It looks like a 300-gram bag of specialty coffee for sure. But it's not. It's soul-popped, soul food-inspired popcorn. So there is heavenly macaroni and cheese flavor.
I have Austin smoke barbecue.
I have banana pudding. And more you eat this, the better it gets.
But the bad news is I can't eat popcorn while having my microphone on. So this is the part of the podcast where I mute my microphone so that I can chew popcorn.
I mean, nobody ever said I want banana pudding and popcorn at the same time.
Yeah, that's a weird combo. I wouldn't have expected that.
Soul Popped made it happen because their slogan is, where popcorn and soul meet.
Okay. Ooh, they should hire you to do their radio ads.
Thanks for thinking of us, Dexter, and for your kind, gracious gift to our podcast today. Hey, if you're a parent, this is one of those topics that you might need to decide whether it's suitable, depending on how young your kids are, to listen to this in the car or with the family around, because we are going to talk about where the trans conversation is headed. And that's just obviously a conversation about sexuality and a conversation about sort of culture. And there's going to be things in this podcast that you may want to just be in charge of when your kids encounter those and how. But what we wanted to do, so a friend sent me this article a few weeks ago. Obviously, part of what we try to do on this podcast is just to be attentive to culture and to where the culture is in conflict with Christianity and with the message of Jesus. And one of those places, as we've talked about repeatedly recently, is in the area of sexual ethics. You'll remember a few weeks ago, we did an episode where we basically said Aaron Wren's negative world hypothesis is true if applied to sexual ethics. It certainly is a world where the paradigm of what is acceptable in terms of sexual identity and ethics is very different from where it was 15 years ago. So we always want to be attentive to, because that affects so many aspects of our lives. It affects what our kids are experiencing in school. It affects our conversations about sexual ethics. It affects what people consider freedom to be and what rights people think they have. This is just a place where we always sort of want to be helping Christians think out ahead of where are things going. And when a friend of mine sent me this article, I was like, oh, this is where things are going. And this is a pretty dystopian world, the case that this person is trying to make. This article is from New York Magazine, and it is titled Freedom of Sex. The author is Andrea Long Chu, who is a transgender woman, which is another way of saying a man who has decided to identify as a woman. So I always get confused if, like, when we're talking about transgender woman and transgender man. See, this is why this language is so confusing.
Yeah.
This is a man who now identifies as a woman
yeah.
and presents as a woman and wants us to call him a woman. And so for, I guess we're going to use she, because I guess that's what you have to do.
I'm sitting going, do we refer to
we're not into pronoun hospitality. We're just trying to say, like, if you were going to talk about this person, how would you talk about them in broader culture?
It's probably less confusing to say she.
Yeah. So she has written this piece. The subtitle is "The Moral Case for Letting Trans Kids Change Their Bodies." I want to summarize the substance of the article for you, because basically what you need to know is, like, this is where the leading edge of the trans movement is headed. Who knows if this is where the culture is going to go, but you need to know where the trans movement would like us to go, because it's important that you're aware of this. And I think this is one of those topics that is going to continue to be on the radar in our culture. And so it behooves us to know where would people like to take us, so that we can perhaps, by the grace of God, resist that, oppose that, rebel against that, work against that, and move things in a different direction. I guess the simple way to say it is, Andrea Longchu believes that kids should have the freedom to change their bodies and their sexual identity for any reason, at any time, with any justification. There should be absolutely no boundaries, no limits, and no arguments about that. Yeah. Is that a fair way of summarizing it, guys?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. After 25 pages, I think you did a good job.
Well, yeah. It's like a long article. It's a long form piece, so it does take a long time to read. And she is clearly opposed to anyone who disagrees with her argument. I mean, she says, she uses the language of the anti-trans bloc repeatedly. And the anti-trans bloc in her mind includes the religious right, that's all of us who are Christians, gender critical feminists, that's people like J.K. Rowling, and then liberals. That's anyone who believes, like, I believe in freedom, but I think there should be some boundaries and limits on it. So she says, all of you together, you religious right Christians, you gender critical feminists, and you classical liberals, all of you are anti-trans. And you're the ones trying to hold us back, but here's where we need to go. We need to go in the direction of radical sexual freedom. And I guess the case she's making most simply is, you know, right now, if people want to have sex change surgery, let's say, you know, As a society, we generally think, well, first they need to be convinced that they're in the wrong body. They need to identify as the opposite gender. They need to go through some therapy to convince people that they really are convinced that they're in the wrong body. And then, like, after that all happens, sometimes in some parts of our society, we will allow them to transition. And I say we loosely, because I don't think they should, but societally, that does happen. She is saying, no one should have to adopt a different gender identity. We shouldn't have to convince you we want to change our body. Your 9-year-old should be able to show up and say, hey, I want you to cut off my genitals and put me on puberty blockers, and that should be fine. You should have no questions about that. No one should oppose that. It's a very radical, radical, radical view of autonomy and freedom. Let me read you the conclusion of her article, and then we'll talk about it. I am speaking here of a universal birthright, the freedom of sex. This freedom consists of two principal rights: the right to change one's biological sex without appealing to gender, and the right to assume a gender that is not determined by one's sexual biology. In general, we must rid ourselves of the idea that any necessary relationship exists between sex and gender. What does this freedom look like in practice? Let anyone change their sex. Let anyone change their gender. Let anyone change their sex again. Let trans girls play sports regardless of their sex status. Let people use the gender-segregated facilities of their choice. Do not out children to their parents. Do not force anyone to change their sex or gender. Give everyone health care. As for transition-related care, the right to change sex includes the right to receive counseling, to understand the risks, or to be treated for comorbidities. To make thoughtfulness a requirement of any of these rights is to taper it into an exclusive privilege. So hear what she's saying there. She's just saying, like, you should pay for any surgery that anyone wants to have at any time and should be okay with it. And it's basically like a radical, radical, radical view of individual autonomy and freedom, apart from what your motivations are, what your mental health is, whether you have anyone affirming or not affirming that choice and decision. It's a very sort of like stripped down radical view of human autonomy that you should be able to just sort of like reshape your sexuality and gender in any ways you want. And that those two things don't even have to be connected to each mm-hmm. other. As Christians, this should shock you. This should surprise you. This should bother you. And you should know there are people in our society that really want to take us in this direction. That's not good.
This line that she writes is very interesting, where she says, the belief that we have a moral duty to accept reality just because it is real is, I think, a fine definition of nihilism, however you want to pronounce it.
Isn't that the dumbest line ever?
I'm like, really? Yeah. So we don't have to accept reality.
So just think about, though, when I read that line, Chris, I was like, well, there is the idolatry of this position.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because what we would say is reality is what God has created.
Givenness of life. Yeah.
And so it's not nihilism. It's actually just like conformity to the world we actually live in.
Mm-hmm.
What she is saying is if you think we have a moral duty to accept reality just because it is, that's nihilism, which is basically a way of saying, I am God. There is no God. Whatever I want to do in the world, whether it conforms to reality or not, should be fine with you.
Yeah.
And that is a radically anti-creation, anti-Christian, idolatrous, and selfish sort of way of thinking about life.
If you're like me and you're reading through this article, the thing that I kept thinking about was regret. Mm. And she doesn't get to regret till the very end. And she says, regret is freedom projected into the past. So it is one thing to regret the outcome of a decision, but it's a very different thing to regret the freedom to decide, which most people would not trade for the world. And we would say, actually, true freedom comes with some structure.
Right.
True and what flourishing comes with boundaries.
What she's saying is if you're not free to regret, then you're not really free. Which I'm thinking, like, how unloving is it to say, like, well, you might regret this later, but just go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
Because that's what it means for you to be free. Like, no one who loves someone would say, if there's a chance you might regret this, I at least want to slow you down and say, Chris, are you sure?
Yeah. I want you to experience the freedom of regret. That's the most important thing. That I don't want to take your right away to regret something.
When I was reading about all the freedom language in there, I was thinking about a trip to Uganda, Africa that I took, and we flew into Kampala, and then we drove 4 hours into the wilderness, basically. It was one of those trips where you're like, I don't really know where we're going.
Where are we?
We're just trusting somebody. There's zero traffic laws. So like, sometimes you meet a car, you go left. Sometimes you meet a car, you go right. Some, you know, you just kind of, it's like chicken all the way to the village. You're just playing chicken all the way to the village. And that's actually what I thought about in here, because it'd be interesting to have a conversation.
Yeah, that's real freedom.
Just about traffic lights. Like,
yeah,
should we stop or not stop? I don't know. Don't make me stop. I'm going to do whatever I want.
Yeah.
So if you put it in a different context, I think she could be more logical. I assume she would be.
Yeah. Here's what is very fascinating to me about this article. Not, I mean, in some ways you're like, wow, this is a very extreme argument. But what is fascinating to me is why she is making this argument. It would seem, and I've read several pieces in response, it would seem she is pressing it this far because the arguments that are being made for trans rights, specifically with kids, are actually losing in the culture. Mm. And one of the examples that why it's losing is because of the growing sort of research around this in the medical community, like more and more and more, you can't run to a study to say, oh no, this is, you know, sex reassignment is the best way to, you know, cure gender dysphoria or whatever, where the research is actually showing more and more that it's not. So she wants to move it away from empiricism, medical based sort of research, because if it stays there much longer, it's, if we're talking specifically with kids, that the argument is going to be lost. And as an example of this, you look at what's happening in France, Sweden, Finland, Norway, and the Netherlands. Not bastions of right-wing politics.
Yeah, none of those places is conservative, as we would think of it.
That based on research that is coming out of those countries, they are hitting the brakes on gender reassignment surgery, puberty blockers, like all these things for kids, because the data and the research is showing that this is actually not healthy. This is not good. At worst, and at best, is inconclusive. So what's interesting to me about this argument is I think she recognizes what's happening and the argument that is being lost. And that's why she, you know, she wanders through the different arguments and gets kind of gender study, you know, dense on some of this stuff, because she's like, hey, if we don't go this extreme, we're going to actually lose the argument.
Well, you sent us a counter piece by Helen Lewis, who's sort of a British, you know, center left thinker. And one of her critiques was like, oh yeah, this is how radical people, they want to push the argument so far in a direction that it sort of like makes the rest of us respond.
Yeah.
And I thought she had some sort of amusing things to say about like, well, yeah, this is what this person does. You know, sort of like, yes. This is the kind of writer they are.
Yeah.
They do these kinds of things.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think for Christians just to have, you know, sometimes we are naive in the sense that we're like, well, I mean, dude, we live in Omaha. Like, you know,
it's fine.
My neighbors aren't trying to like change their gender and stuff. And so we sort of like can be very short-sighted in where we think things are. Reading pieces like this and realizing there are academic thinkers and journalists out there making these kinds of arguments should at least open our eyes to like, oh, we need to like fight this kind of thinking at every level, because there are people out there that are really trying to move our society in this direction. That shouldn't make us fearful. It shouldn't make us anxious, but it should make us aware and alert and wanting to double down on the givenness of creation, the reality of moral limits, the reality of responsibilities, not just rights, and the realities of sex and gender being connected. Because part of what she's saying in this article is those two things should be just whatever sex you want to have, whatever gender you want to have, they shouldn't relate to each other in any way. Feel free to display and present however you want. And so for Christians to be aware that like these are the arguments out there in our culture helps us, I think, pray better, helps us act better, helps us attend to where we need to strengthen our theology and our clarity so that we can make compelling arguments in these cases, and so that we can protect our kids as necessary from some of these dynamics that filter their way into places you wouldn't expect.
The other interesting thing, you know, you mentioned like being in the middle of America, and so this isn't really going to touch us, and we're having a conversation about where the conversation is headed, and so we do need to think rightly about it, but we also do have folks who have friendships and connections to people who have underwent surgery or who are taking hormones, and so this is a discipleship issue as well. Like this, it's not happening to everybody. I mean, not all of us are in these conversations, but there is a minority of folks, probably in both of our churches, who are having these kinds of relationships and friendships. And so we need to also figure out how to disciple our way through this whole new world.
Yeah. And knowing that in this very narrow world, these are the kinds of arguments that are out there. And so, yeah, if you have a family member or a friend who, you know, identifies as trans or who is thinking about gender transition, those kinds of things, these are the kinds of things they're taking in. So they're probably not trying to convince you of why this is a good idea. They probably are on the extreme end of like, hey, Dusty, I should be able to do whatever I want, and it's not really any of your business. There's a knowledge component there of just how can we love the people around us by understanding the things they're hearing and perhaps the worldview that they're coming from.
And I think we're going to be discipling, evangelizing, welcoming people into the church who have gone through these kinds of things. They have, you know, you're going to be having a conversation with somebody who has underwent a surgery. And so for them to surrender their life to Christ and come into the Lordship and Kingship of Jesus Christ is also going to mean something bodily for them as well. And we haven't had to cross that very much. At least we have, but just not in this particular way.
Yeah. And what you can kind of see happening somewhat in real time is how presuppositions and arguments are made, where the whole reason that she can make this argument and it even be given a hearing and not sound like absolute just crazy town is because there was this other shift that we're because of what we're dealing with now. Mm. So the kind of the arguments that are being made now have laid a groundwork for this extreme of an argument. And this is how things happen. Like, how do we get to, you know, X idea that seems so crazy, you know, 50 years ago, is because little by little, what do they say? Like the Overton window, like what's acceptable, what's considered acceptable continues to get shifted. And so you can entertain more radical and radical ideas because our expectations have shifted. And so this goes to just seeing how society changes in some ways and see the ways that arguments are made. So I think it's just a cultural conversation. This is fascinating because you're seeing it happen in real time, because even who she attacks the most in this article is not conservative Christian. She actually goes at liberals.
Yeah.
Like, you're not radical enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when you see the same side, so to speak, starting to turn on each other, that's when you know the conversation has gotten really interesting and something is probably going to change one way or another. Either sanity is going to be restored because of what the medical community is showing, or they're just going to blast through empirical evidence and sort of the groundedness of the medical community and just go pure theory and pure ideology and just push this more extreme.
That is interesting. You can see that this writer is very ideological, and she sees this as like a political advocacy kind mm-hmm. of a moment, not as a, in fact, she wants to untether it from anything medical. You know, she's really trying to say, like, who cares about what the medical community says? This is a fight for the political justice, quote unquote, of the right to do whatever we want with our bodies.
Yeah. Yeah. She's like straight activist.
Now, I want to draw a connection that I'm fascinated by and that I think Christians should think about more. And that is the connection to our view of freedom, because this is downstream from, so I've been doing a lot of work lately on liberalism. What I mean by that is just the American vision of freedom, you know, the Declaration of Independence. All people are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? So our understanding of freedom is built on sort of a radical view of personal autonomy. And, you know, for a few hundred years, that served us pretty well. But in the last probably 60 years, the trajectory of liberalism has been basically, how do we remove more and more constraints? If the good life is to be maximally free, and maximally free as an individual, then how do we remove the most possible constraints to freedom? And this is the sort of like nth degree of that, because actually the logic she's using in this argument is the logic of autonomy and freedom. Me being maximally free means me being free to change whatever I want to about myself, sex, gender, how my body looks, whether I go through puberty at all. I mean, the most radical thing she says in this article, and Mary Harrington points this out too, is that there's a subset of this movement that thinks everyone should have to consent to going through puberty.
Yeah, I remember that line. That was wild.
So there's a vanguard of this movement that wants to say puberty, the natural process of human maturation, should require consent. So your 11-year-old should get to say, yep, I want to go ahead and go through puberty and be a girl or a boy, or nope, I don't want to go through puberty. And that's insane.
Yes.
But that's where this is headed. And it's rooted in this radical sense of that I am a self untethered to bodily reality. Like I'm just sort of like a mind. And that freedom means I should be so free that I get to decide everything about my reality. And you can see how this is basically the Garden of Eden all over again, right? You will be like God. What does it mean to be free? It means maximal freedom. It means you can define your own reality, as opposed to a vision of freedom that says there's a givenness to the world and you are free within the limits and boundaries of what it means for you to be an embodied human being. And so that vision of maximal freedom that liberalism has given us has gotten us to this point. And I think it's interesting to ask the question, where is the wrong turn there? Is it in a poor application of liberalism, or is it baked into the cake itself of like when we bought into the idea of freedom that John Locke and Thomas Jefferson and all of those guys gave us, this is where we were bound to end up.
Yeah.
And I don't know the answer, but that's an interesting question.
Yeah, that's a question that I've noticed is being asked more and more often. And I'm curious by it too, because if you think of where this sort of enlightenment notions of freedom, it still very much was within Christendom, and had certain Christian assumptions and certain understandings of the givenness of life. And so their definitions were operating with certain assumptions, and that just sort of gone out the window. And is that necessary that that's the trajectory that they were always going to be on? Or is it a corruption of, you know, Locke and Jefferson and others? That's probably another podcast. Once you've come to your conclusion after all your reading,
I'm working on it.
Well,
the problem is every time I finish one book on it, I'm like, oh, I probably need to read some more on that. So I'm never going to come to a conclusion, but I'm developing lots of thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, while you guys have been talking, I've just been muting my microphone.
I think you just finished that whole bag, didn't you?
Heavenly. How heavenly is your heavenly mac and cheese over there?
It's real good. I'm not going to kid you.
Where popcorn and soul meet.
Soul popped. I've been enjoying it while we've been talking.
Okay, so where's this thing headed? Like, do you think it implodes soon?
I think what Chris said is true. I never want to underestimate the Americans' ability to ignore reality, because we're good at that. But I do think the fact that many, many, many European countries are now banning puberty blockers and sort of slowing their quickness to embrace all the trans medicine, I think that will eventually win the day. I still think at the end of the day, we're a country that believes in evidence-based medicine. And I think these activists, I do think that the battle within sort of the liberal stream, within sort of classical liberals, and then these activist radicals who sort of are, you know, the activist liberals are saying, let's follow the medicine, follow the science. And the radicals are saying maximal freedom at all costs. And I think that, I don't think that's where things will go. Although, you know, who knows? So that's part of why we're talking about this, is just, I think it's wise for us to understand that there is a segment of our population that wants us to go that way, so that we can be wiser about how we engage these conversations.
Yeah. My guess is that because, you know, follow the science, because that is so also baked into our understanding of things as a society, that where we ultimately land is not anywhere that Christians would support. But it's probably going to be an adjustment within a framework of, hey, you know, trans rights for adults, which is going to be its own battle. You know, do we allow trans women and trans men to compete in sports and those kinds of things? But when it comes to kids, I could see a kind of a dialing back what happens based on sort of the evidence. And so we're not, as Christians, we're not going to love where it lands. We're not going to like, and we're going to be against it. But in some ways, it might be more sane. I don't know, more guardrails around it. That's probably the best case scenario of what we could hope for.
I've been reading a lot of the reactionary feminists. So, you know, you sent us a piece from Helen Lewis, Mary Harrington, Louise Perry, Erica Bacciocchi, all these people who are sort of, would consider themselves feminists, but what they're reacting against is progress and the way progressivism has corrupted what feminism was. And one of the things that they, I mean, it's not Christians saying this, it's these reactionary feminists saying this, is that within that radical stream, there is very much an intentional desire to undermine the family and to basically get us to the place where we have artificial wombs. You don't have to have a mother and a father in order to have a baby. We've outsourced all of the sort of like processes of life, because that's the most maximally free society. That's the society of individual choice. And what they all point out is that's a society that only works for rich people, because to access all that stuff, it's going to cost you dollars.
Sure.
And so part of what I think our critique needs to be as Christians is to say, one, we believe in the givenness of sex, gender, and of the goodness of the family. But two, we believe that there is an economic vision the gospel gives us that's something different than maximal capitalism, something different than just as long as you can afford it, do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And I think unless we dial that in and do some healthy work to sort of ask, what is a Christian economics? We're probably not doing the fullness of work.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. It's a more robust and fuller comprehensive picture. Because you can go, if you think of just take the economic piece of it, and we can even sound like good Marxists. Like, look at all the places of oppression and how you're going to, you know, pay some poor woman to be your womb for you. And just like the things that that does.
Yeah.
That as Christians, we'd be like, hey, that's terrible for multiple reasons. And so we may be the champions of justice in ways that the world is not going to be.
Yes. And we're going to need to be sort of like anti-capitalist in some important ways in the near future. And we'll maybe talk more about that in podcasts to come. Thanks, Dexter, for the Soul Popped Popcorn from Austin, Texas.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thank you for listening in. And we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We always love to hear from listeners. So if you have thoughts, questions, future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.